And so I think that's really helpful for us who want to be change makers. And I think really it's like, I would call hope punk politics, or like a real activism based on hope punk, which is, if we have an idea of how we want things to be, can we think of small actions and experiences, rituals maybe, that bring that identity to life? You know, people can only have an identity if they're living it and experiencing it. And so human beings can change. We're capable of harm, but also kindness. And so we have to try and shape not just the society, but actually ourselves as human beings. And maybe actually a real hope punk radical goal I've been thinking lately is literally just evolving ourselves to just be, have more empathy and kindness.
Hope Punk is a podcast about choosing hope in the face of adversity. Hope, meant as an activating force, not wishful thinking. The term was originally coined by fantasy author Alexandra Rowland, who in 2017 wrote a Tumblr post simply stating, "The opposite of grimdark is hope punk. Pass it on." Now, grimdark is a particularly dystopian subgenre of science fiction, and hope punk doesn't negate that dystopia exists, but it says, in the face of it, choose hope anyway. In a world that is unkind, just being kind in itself is a radical act. And while some would want to make us believe otherwise, hope punk is everywhere. That's why it is my intention with this podcast to shine a light on the people, projects, and spaces that embody hope-inspired action every day. What is the meaning of hope for us personally, in the face of illness or loss, for instance? And given the current state of the world, how does hope, or the lack thereof, shape our politics and society? My guest today is Thomas Coombs, and I cannot think of anyone more suited to kick off the English-speaking segment of this podcast than Thomas. He's founder of Hope-Based Communications, an initiative that promotes using hope as an effective strategy for change, informed by psychology, neuroscience, and history. Thomas has spent 2 decades in global political communication, including roles as head of brand at Amnesty International and speechwriter at the European Commission. He embodies hope punk to me, not just because he works with hope, that's a no-brainer, but also because he really dives deep into the why. He brings his personal history and experience to the table. I will link to his TED Talk from a couple of years ago in the show notes. And he literally transforms fear and pessimism into hope. In his human rights work, he has spent years looking more closely at the dystopia in this world than many of us would even dare. And in the face of it, he actively chooses to apply hope as a lever for change. So thank you very much, Thomas, for being here.
Oh, thank you. That's such a nice introduction. I don't think I want to say anything else.
But what is your take on hope? This is the question I ask everyone who comes into the podcast. I guess it's a no-brainer for you.
It is a no-brainer, but I have actually been thinking about it a lot lately because I noticed something in myself, which is if I see someone use the wrong in definition of hope, I get defensive. You know, and I notice we have that. We'll talk a lot about fear, but I think fear is an emotion that makes us want to control. And part of my work in the communication side is the fact that concepts like hope mean different things to different people. And so one of the things that often happens, particularly in progressive spaces, is we always fight over the definition of things. So my basic starting point is I like to talk about hope as the belief that tomorrow can be better than today if we make it happen. But I think that sense of belief is something that's really important, I think, for politics. But, you know, I was thinking about it's actually kind of helpful to maybe use like an extra term. And I rediscovered something from, I'd met an academic called Anna Cecilia Dienerstein, who'd been working with the sort of Marxist definition of hope, which comes from Ernst Bloch. And she'd done this really interesting work on activists in Latin America. And so she talks about organizing hope, because the definition of hope in that space is, it is this word prefiguring the future in the present. I think I'm trying to decide, is that word prefiguring a word that we can use day to day, or is it too technical in Marxist jargon? But it's actually a perfect word. So she uses the example of, say, landless farmers in Brazil just reclaiming the land. So not waiting for the law, but actually doing it. Or workers in Argentina during financial crisis at the start of the century, taking control of the factories. And the point being is, we don't just complain about the world. We don't wait for change to happen. We start doing it right now. And so, yeah, because I'm constantly rethinking of that definition. I've started to talk a lot more just about organized hope, because, you know, it makes that a lot of people have that negative concept that like hope is passive. So I think it's actually helpful to, you know, everyone can define hope their own way. So I've lately started talking a lot about organized hope, because the point is we all just have to organize together to start bringing to life these better futures in the present.
Wonderful. When I looked at your website, you have a couple of quotes by thinkers that inform your work. And one was, maybe it goes along the veins of what you just said, Martha Nussbaum. You quoted her as a philosopher. Hope involves a vision of the good world that might ensue, and often at least actions related to getting there. And that in relation to another one, where you said good messaging is not about saying what is popular, it is about making popular what needs to be said. So the two of those really helped me understand what exactly you are trying to do with hope-based communications. Maybe a word to understand how you got to where you are today. You started off in human rights work, amongst other places. You worked a long time for Amnesty International. Would you want to say a little bit maybe about why you went into that field, and what made you sort of do the switch from fear to hope-based? If that's even how you can say it.
No, that's exactly how I would say it. And that quote really relates to it. So, I mean, for me, I somehow already had a very laser clear mission in life, because my family were Holocaust survivors. And the story I took from my family was that this was not about something that happened to one group of people, but something humans did to humans. And that I just got this sense, especially from my mother, that like we have a duty to all other people facing the same experience: Palestinians, Yazidi, Rohingya, Bosnian Muslims. You know, and so that is basically like became really my mission in life. So I always wanted to do something. I had no idea what I actually could do as one small human being, but that took me very clearly into politics and into human rights, and I think also communication, because I wanted people to care, and I wanted these stories to be heard. And so I was very much traditional, very angry, full of fear and outrage person. I was trying to raise awareness and what we call the human rights naming and shaming violations. But it was around 2016 when it just felt that actually that just approach wasn't working, because people could see the suffering and yet it wasn't leading to empathy and compassion. And around that time, I guess what's lucky working in a big organization like Amnesty International is that a lot of experts came. So you just quoted Anat Shenk-Rosorio, who talks about messaging. So she is a messaging expert. And she and several others were the people who started bringing these new ways of thinking to my attention. And particularly Anat came and just said, you know, when you make people afraid, they're more likely to support the populist. And then I looked at my communication, my messaging, which was all about the crisis we're in and what a dangerous time this is. And I realized that my communication was fear-based, was the word Anat used. And I realized, okay, how am I going to switch away from that? And it just simply involves saying, well, what's the opposite of fear? And I somehow landed on hope and thinking, okay, so we need to actually be hope-based, not fear-based. So I didn't arrive at hope through any sort of, which is, I ironically now took the Twitter handle or social media handle of the hope guy, very ironically, because I was like the least hopeful person in the room. I grew up with a very negative and sort of a lot of anger in my family for obvious reasons. It's really not a natural thing for me. And that's maybe why I've been the one selling it, because I've seen it really in a very sort of pure rational light, that the purpose of being hope-based, first of all, is to say how things could be, not just how they are. So if we want actual change, we have to talk about that change. It's not enough to just say things are not going well. So the people we work for at Amnesty International and other activist groups, unless we can actually change the situation of the people we're working for, then it's not enough. You know, so I also have that instinct, I think, because of that mission. It makes me probably very annoying, because I'm always questioning our strategy in Amnesty and other places, because for me, it's not enough to just do the job and then go home. I really have that sense when I was at Amnesty, I'm going through the door. It's like, you know, I'm doing this for my grandparents, right, as I walk through the door. So the way then evolved was I had that kind of eureka moment, thanks to Anat and the brain science showing me, okay, if I want empathy and compassion, we have to do things a little differently. But also realizing, you know, I can't just go and tell all my colleagues who've been doing work the certain way. for a really long time to just suddenly change completely what they're doing. And so since then, that was around 2016, this approach has been evolving. The purpose of this hope-based communication, first of all, it's to be focused on the hope, not the fear, but it's also about everyone doing it for themselves. So it's not about me going and telling people what the hopeful message should be. It's about people finding the hope inside themselves. And crucially, this is the sort of the hardest thing to get across in activism. It's not about telling hopeful stories. It's about finding the hope in every story.
That's a really important point. You have been reading, diving into the neuroscience of how our brains work. And now you teach hope-based to other people as well. You do trainings. You are a community, right? Is would you say hope-based is a community or is it an approach?
Oh,
is it both?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's both, I would say. Yeah. So I just instinctively didn't want to create like an agency or a business with this because I developed it because I just felt the human rights work is not working enough. And so we need to change. So it's really, I developed it, as you say, as an approach for people to ask themselves questions. And so to me, the goal is for as many people to use it as possible. So I basically put a Creative Commons license on it, saying anyone can take and use this. And then, you know, I was fortunate enough that other people actually, this resonated. I think creating this structure, actually, some colleagues have told me, it gave them permission to sort of act on what they'd already been feeling. I think a lot of people in social change felt this need for hope, but the brain science kind of gives it that sort of credibility. And so, yeah, so we're basically, there was so much demand actually for it that I realized, okay, I can't do this myself. And I just started training other people to also do the trainings. So right now, actually, I've just joined two friends who built this thing called Rogue Union. So it's like an online global training community for social change people around the world. And so I spent last year with this lovely new camera recording the workshop that I've been doing over the last 5 years. So the point is anyone can do it. And I'm really working hard this year. Actually, I just want to get everything out of my brain and out to other people to use it. So I'm like writing a book, recording more and more videos. At the same time, as it gets very complicated, trying to keep it really, really simple around these five shifts that anyone can ask themselves, like I said, to find the hope in their story. But I think above all, reframe their message and their work based on how things could be, not just how they are.
Can you walk us through these five shifts?
Absolutely. So our starting point is fear to hope. And with that, I talk a bit about the emotions. So I'm again inviting people to just think, what are the emotions we need people to feel? So actually yesterday I was giving a talk and someone said, what about anger? You don't talk about anger very much. And we could go into that. But what I again want to always say here is I'm talking about hope. I've had this whole thing, but it's also just about choosing emotions strategically. And so maybe there are times to be angry, but just think what happens when people are angry, you know? And so think strategically about emotions. Second is problem to solution. So again, we're very likely to focus on the problem, but we need to show people there's an alternative. So really what I want to just try and train activists there is we have this natural pull to fear and to problems. So you're never going to not talk about them, but just notice when you are and add the solution too, because that's again, that change. There's really interesting brain science behind that one, which I think is worth a quick digression on, is that our brains are prediction machines. So we're making decisions based on what we already know. And that means that if we've got this vision of the future, I think this is very important for Hope Punk. If people have never seen a vision of a future, say, where we're united as human beings with no nations anymore, for example, right? If people have never seen that, they can not only never do it, they can't even support it. So I think that's such a major shift for activism and which anyone who wants to make change, that the first step isn't actually to say things are wrong. The first step is to show, oh, look, here's the alternative. And that I think is...
This is what things could look like kind of thing.
And the sort of brain science really makes just to me a very clear case that, you know, if you're not doing that, then change will never happen. Shift three then is from against to for, and this is just copied directly from Annette, who we've quoted earlier. She came to Amnesty and said that. And I thought, okay, that just has to be a shift on its own, because again, we think so much in terms of what we're against. We have all this vocabulary, we're anti-racist, anti-fascist. I'm all of those things. But what I realized is it's actually quite hard for people to say, if you're against those things, what are you for? And it might be worth talking about later, but I mean, you know, it feels kind of talking about radical. if we're against hatred and cruelty, we're actually for love and kindness. Yes. And for example, I saw a poster just on my run this morning, another anti-AFD protest. And I always think, well, what would happen? First of all, that means all of our attention is focused on them. We're centering our attention on them. We're putting them in the spotlight.
The AFD being the alternative for Germany, because you're based in Berlin.
Yes.
Which I should probably mention.
I was assuming I would all had an old German audience. You're totally right. Yes. Thank you. So I saw another poster for a protest against the far right party in Germany. And as has been happening all over the world, that the thing that makes us angry, the thing we're against, attracts a lot of our energy and attention. But there's a researcher in the United States called Whitney Phillips who says, exposing things to sunlight is meant to get rid of them. It's meant to disinfect. But actually in the world, sunlight makes things grow. And so what would happen if those protesters who want to protest against the Alternative for Deutschland and any other far-right group, what if we all came together for something? Like welcoming refugees, for example. So that is that major shift we need to bring about. And to me, the work just starts on a really simple level of just putting words to it. Because actually our vocabularies are really tilted to what we're against. Shift four is threat to opportunity. And this is where we really think of audiences. How do we change people's mind? And then the final shift is victim to human. So this is a little bit based on us, how we tell stories of people. And because as you know, the old school approach in social change is like poverty porn of showing suffering. And although we've tried to move away from that, we still often put people in that role of victim. And there's also villain story as well. You know, we always feel you have to have a victim and a villain, and then the activists are the hero coming to the rescue. And really, this is just trying to remind people again to just humanize stories. And so even people who are suffering actually still have hope. And that's something that activists find really hard to do. But so as you said, like thinking about my grandparents, for example, I was sort of them as the victim. But actually, when I rethink the story through this frame, I think about their resilience, the fact that they never gave up.
This comes across very much in your talk, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe for the listeners, your grandmother, right, was pregnant when she fled France.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what I actually, maybe it's worth going back a little bit. So back in 2016, when I started on this journey to hope, Amnesty had a really wonderful project called Give a Home, where they teamed up with this cool organization called SOFAR to hold concerts in people's living room to encourage welcoming of refugees. And I was in one of those places, and it was the first time ever that I actually shared this story. I'd for a very long time just didn't tell people I was Jewish. And so I was living in the United Kingdom at the time. And I thought, okay, actually, I'm going to share this story now. And I told my grandmother's story without telling them it was my grandmother. I just said there was a refugee brought to the border and they faced a barbed wire fence. And the person, the sort of, I didn't say trafficker, but in French it's called the passeur, the person who helps someone cross the border, left them there. And they were faced with this barbed wire fence. And my grandfather, at the time, the way I said it was that, you know, her husband said, well, we have to turn back. But she, because she was pregnant, climbed over the fence, even though it was barbed wire and her hands were bleeding. And they got to the other side. And the police, who had been sending most people back, doing what's called refoulement, like sending back refugees to the police, were made like rare exceptions because she was pregnant. And it was at that stage in the speech that I said they were asked to fill out the form to claim asylum. And under reason why, he said, because I'm Jewish. And I then obviously said back in 2016, like one of the worst things about this story is that it could be happening right now today. That was also just a very powerful moment for me, because first of all, for the first time, I sort of outed myself and told this story and saw people, it would resonate with people. Because growing up in Ireland, people weren't really very receptive to this story. But I also realized that space was a very safe space. And that's where I had this realization of connecting to brain science, that when people themselves feel safe and comfortable, they are more primed for empathy and openness. And so actually, if we want people to act a certain way, we also have to prime them for those actions. We have to understand, you know, our thinking is biological, it's physical, it's in our body, not just in our mind. And again, I think we have that false dichotomy. And so I realized, actually, more of our refugee communication is to put people in metaphorically in that cozy living room where they can hear this story, rather than the sort of unease we put them. Just for example, if you see a poster saying, you know, these people are suffering and you're living a really comfortable life, you know, we're appealing to guilt there and shame. And that's actually not priming people to be open and welcoming. So yeah, telling that story actually really helped me a lot develop this approach.
So what would you say to people who are scared of what happens when you have so many refugees entering the country? Is there anything that is applicable, you know, to bring those people from fear to hope?
Yeah, absolutely.
To humanize the whole discussion.
Yeah, you know, the first thing I think I would say, if you allow me a word of German, I would say, wir schaffen das. I would say the words Angela Merkel said in 2015, that we're a strong country and we faced challenges before and we can do this, we can get this done. That was actually the perfect message. And what was very interesting at that time when Germany was welcoming hundreds of thousands of people, I remember saying to German activist colleagues, like, this is really good. Like, we got a good leader here compared to some other countries. And they were like, no, she's a conservative. She's not on our side. We don't like her. And so very few people got behind Angela Merkel, actually, from social change and progressive organizations. And that actually, I think, is the moment we lost this issue, because other, you know, at Amnesty and other human rights groups, we should have been pressuring much more boldly other governments to get behind it. And there's plenty of other stories I have around that where I think we really held back. We were, and what continues to this day, there's a fear of sharing our values. So yeah, practically, to go back to your initial question, we can never tell people not to feel a certain emotion. But the point is, human beings are prepared to make sacrifices for a certain vision. We talk about definitions of hope. There's actually a really nice definition of hope. I'm going to be very nerdy. This legal theorist, Richard Rorty, I just found it actually in my local library. He had a book, Hope in Place of Knowledge. And he talked about social hope. And what he meant by social hope is that we as a community striving for that better future. And he says that, you know, like, liberal societies require that we are, share that sense of, like, that we can have a future that's better for all of us. And it's those stories of that better future that prepare us to sacrifice. And I think sometimes in social change, we're afraid to ask people for sacrifice. We want to make it easy for them. And we're afraid to say, yeah, you know, this might be hard work, but it's worth doing. And that, I think, is what that message from Angela Merkel was. And that's, I think, how we address people. It's not about saying this is going to be perfect, it's going to be great. It's just about, this is the right thing to do.
You mentioned before that, you know, listening is an important skill to have when promoting hope as a strategy. When you say identity is so important for belonging, and, you know, right now identity is often politicized in a way of othering, saying we are here and they are there. And this also goes into the refugee discussion, I guess. How, I don't want to go into like a manipulative language, because I believe, you know, I believe that identity is something multifaceted anyway. You know, I'm not just German. I'm also European and I'm a woman. I was born in Spain. I've lived in places that are outside of Europe. So I've always kind of felt just this natural sort of identity that is multi something. Who do you see, for instance, effectively living, or I'm not sure whether promoting is the right word, but the sense of identity that is, you know, I think needed, or an understanding of identity that makes it possible to coexist with people from different cultures, different backgrounds, and, you know, to, so that we can actually live in a democracy that is pluralistic.
Yeah, it's such a great point. You know, I think everything I do has always been driven by the desire to understand, you know, like, understand, how did the Holocaust happen? How do genocides happen? How is there a genocide happening now to the Palestinian people? After all, you know, so many people in Israel who are part of that, what they've gone, you know, just how is this happening? And I found the brain science really helpful for that. It helps me understand why people do terrible things to each other. But it, and, you know, a lot of it is identity and group formation, like you've mentioned. But the brain science also shows us possibilities for change, that we have, our brains are plastic. They're constantly changing based on our experiences. And so all the things you've mentioned, like identity and belonging and how we live together, these are all things that we have the power to shape. You know, so I found myself a certain amount of comfort myself in understanding the psychology of dehumanization, But I now also have a mission of this idea of rehumanization, that again, identity is formed through our experiences. And so I strongly believe in this kind of cosmopolitan identity you've been describing, in multi-group identity, that, you know, believe me, don't all just fit in narrow categories. So again, sometimes we progressives also use that kind of category group thinking too. And so I like to talk about hope as a muscle we can train, but also all these ways of thinking are things we can train. And that's why I think Hope Punk is so important, right? Because again, it's putting new things out there, teach us new ways of being and thinking. I always have this idea that people who watch Star Trek are a little bit more international minded, because we all imagine this world where, you know, all the human race were just one. But it's also, I think, what we can do in the short term are thinking of what are small acts and rituals that bring a certain identity to life. There's a brilliant book out called Don't Talk About Politics. I think she's a neuroscientist, Sarah Stein Lebrano. Really recommend that to everyone. But she makes this case that I was talking about earlier, that debate doesn't work. What actually forms this identity is experience. And so I think that's really helpful for us who want to be change makers. And I think really it's like, I would call hope punk politics, or like a real activism based on hope punk, which is, if we have an idea of how we want things to be, can we think of small actions and experiences, rituals maybe, that bring that identity to life? You know, people can only have an identity if they're living it and experiencing it. And so human beings can change. We're capable of harm, but also kindness. And so we have to try and shape not just the society, but actually ourselves as human beings. And maybe actually a real hope punk radical goal I've been thinking lately is literally just evolving ourselves to just be, have more empathy and kindness.
It kind of sounds like, you know, that gathering you mentioned earlier in that living room. That would be one of those hope punky things to do, bringing people together and just literally enabling conversation between people who have different lived experiences.
Absolutely.
And a lot of those initiatives are very small. They exist. They're very small. They may be very local. They may be running on no funds, on a lot of volunteer work. Do you know of any other initiatives that give you hope in that sense?
Oh, wonderful question. The first thing that comes to mind is Hope Not Hate in the UK. There were a group who were really driving, again, me and my journey to hope, because they did a lot of research in disadvantaged communities. And they literally had the finding that, you know, when people feel less hope for their own future, they're also less welcoming. And they've been doing lots of festivals around the country and small, you know, local groups underneath the umbrella of hope. I've now forgotten the word. They have a beautiful name for it. It's like a festival of hope, but it's got actually a very cool name.
I look it up and put it in the show notes.
Yes, put it in the show notes. But they see almost I think every summer, but really regularly now there's other groups involved. So I'm sorry, the ones I'm forgetting right now. But yeah, just like sometimes it's just parties on a street. I mean, I'm thinking of the imagery, there's like children drawing. And you know what's really interesting is whenever I do workshops, I ask people to draw or imagine a future society where their policies are passed. So whether they're working on removing plastic waste or fighting sexual violence, how would society look different? How would it look different to walk down the street?
How would it feel, perhaps?
How would it feel? How would it smell? What do you hear? So not just, you know, the first instinct of an activist is to show like a court case, you know, or parliament passing a new law. I mean, no. How does it look after that in daily life? And that's really hard at first. And people just started drawing parks full of people playing together. And I thought, maybe my approach, this is silly, like that everyone's just drawing parks. And then it was like in Taiwan, people did that. From the Philippines, activists did it. And like Uganda, Tunisia, and El Salvador, everyone started drawing the same picture of basically community. People around a dinner table together, people in parks. And I was, oh, well, hang on a sec. Like everyone's coming up with the same universal vision. And again, like what brings this to life more than just groups of really diverse people? Maybe one last thing, if you'll allow me, sorry to talk so much.
No, please. That's why it's a podcast.
Yeah. But my wife and I were in Australia this winter to escape the Berlin winter. But we were in Melbourne on Christmas Day, and we don't celebrate Christmas. I've never done it. So I always felt a bit alone on Christmas in Christian countries. And we went to the botanical gardens, and it was just full of people from all over Asia in particular, but all over the world. Basically, the non-Christians were all just having a picnic in the park on a sunny Christmas day. And I was, oh yeah, this is a picture people have been drawing in my workshops. And I think that it, somehow, I don't have the words right now, but that really illustrates, I think, the in just real terms, the this vision we've been talking about. So the way I would describe it is maybe what we need are fewer demos and more dinners.
Yeah, and also perhaps to open up the space of imagination. Imagination is a word that comes to mind listening to you. And of course, also when thinking about science fiction and hope punk, you know, you have those visions of the future about autonomous cars, self-driving cars, colonization of space, yeah. Right? That is currently driving a lot of billionaire dreams.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And shaping a lot of actual technological development around AI and other things. And hope punk, you mentioned the moment when you sort of started thinking about hope in 2016. I mean, that's when Donald Trump first came to power in the US. That's when Alexandra Rowland posted her Tumblr post and basically said, listen, we need something that is opposite to grimdark. Grimdark being something like Game of Thrones, right? And yeah. Hope punk being more
or
like, I don't know, Lord of the Rings. Yes, exactly. Where the world right now, it certainly feels very dystopian at times. So, you know, the power of story and the power of imagination, the power of art. Do you see a connection between, you know, what feels like less space for expression in the arts, you know, cuts of funding for these, at least in Germany right now. Like, I know that there are a lot of initiatives. For instance, one called, I think it's called Alle an einen Tisch. I have to check this, but it is literally organizing dinners with people from different cultures where they can enter into conversation. Cut, right? Yeah. Democracy, education programs, facing cuts, cultural institutions facing cuts. So how do you see a space for us to open this kind of imagination?
Yeah, that's really key. I think that's actually really the key question of our time. And something I think about a lot working in activism. How do we fund really, you know, innovative, creative work? To go back to the nerdy element of it, this Richard Rorty guy, who's like a real like legal theorist, what I really liked in this point of saying hope in place of knowledge is that so much of I think politics, you know, and political thinking and activism is all about this knowledge, right? If we document the harms and the crimes and the problems, that's almost like that's enough. But knowing about things is not enough. And Rory actually has this line about actually, what if instead of chasing that knowledge, we try to cultivate our imagination to imagine how things could be different and better? And I think maybe the work we have to do is change what we value in the world and change this common sense that, like, you know, the economy and security come first. And it's obviously, it's nice to have, you know, I think there's this idea, it's nice to have the cultural things, but we've got to have the newspapers and we've got to have our academics and our, you know, all that comes first. And the culture is a nice little thing on the side. And what we need to do is change our understanding of human beings, I think. You know, we have this AI revolution, we could have an EI revolution, emotional intelligence, where if we actually understand how humans work and how, you know, our emotions drive us and how much of our behavior and decision-making is driven by culture, by our bodies, and by the way we act, maybe what we need to do is change our mindset to see how central that culture is to our lives and also, you know, like what gives meaning to our lives.
Richard Rorty also came up with
the veil of ignorance. The thing is, like, he's known for that more theoretical stuff. And what's funny is when you know, I just randomly saw that book in the library. It's, oh, he also talked about hope. And actually, oh, this is exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah. The veil of ignorance, I remember reading this in a seminar at university ages ago. So this just literally popping back into my head. Yeah. But, you know, just imagine. Yeah. Not knowing into what circumstances you will be born in the future automatically forces you into a very, very concrete empathy.
Exactly, yeah.
For others, because you do not know. If you really try to feel what it would feel like to be born anywhere in the world, what kind of circumstances would you like to promote today to be able to be a bit more certain that you will be able to live a peaceful life, because in essence, you know, that's what I do believe, that most people in the world kind of, you know, want to live in peace.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're also describing is what I see as the future of human rights work. The only question is, can I convince other people that that's the future? Is literally just training empathy. Empathy is a muscle that is something that we can train our ability to take different perspectives, which is what you've just described, and, you know, see other groups and, you know, it's not that we can know what it's like, you know, to have experienced suffering, but we can try and see their perspective. And that's something we can train. And, you know, maybe in school, we need to learn less about, you know, entrepreneurship and more about empathy, for example.
When you think of the network of people that work with you on hope-based communications, who inspires you right now? Like, who gives you hope? Because you have people all over the world who are using this approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe top of mind for me is in Romania, Romania's biggest feminist women's rights organization, Centrofilia. I did a workshop with them like 2 or 3 years ago now. And at first they were like, well, you know, we deal with really hard stuff like violence against women, like how are we meant to be hopeful and not talk about victims when we're talking about victims of violence? And I always find the people who are very resistant at first tend to be the ones who really embrace the approach because they really care. And people who care want to make sure they're doing things the best way and can't help answering the questions that come with these five shifts. And so Christina Praz is their communications person. And so she took part in one of my certification courses to be a trainer herself. And she wrote to me 2 weeks ago and said that she's run her first workshop. And she shared back, you know, the people she trained had the same problem she had at first of like, how do we talk about hope when we're dealing with dark things? But then they realized, yeah, we also, it's about empowering the people who have those experiences to share their whole story, their hopes and their aspirations, not their fear. And then something else that she talked about was, you know, when trying to bring this shift to their communication work, at first, but what if we get less engagement when we talk about hope and when we talk about fear? But she also realized that it's also about changing how we measure the success of our work. Is it just about those metrics of like how many clicks? They did one piece of content which involved a real lesbian couple in Romania. And after it was trying to make the case for care in politics. And then loads of their supporters wrote to them and said, other lesbians said, this is the first time we see ourselves represented in Romanian culture. We've never seen ourselves like on the screen before. And that was such a powerful point. You know, like we always worried about, oh, are we going to get enough attention? You know, if we move away from how we communicate now to something else, what if we don't get as much media coverage? But, you know, if you're getting a lot of media coverage reinforcing a harmful idea and you get a little bit of coverage that makes few people feel seen, what's more important?
Yeah. Maybe this is a bit of a shift.
We're all about shifts,
to another topic. Yeah, exactly. But a couple of weeks ago, you shared a story about speaking in the European Parliament. Yeah. And you actually started everyone off with a breathing exercise. Can you go into why you did that and what happened?
Yeah, I've never gotten more response on social media than from this little video, which I really was really unplanned. So I was at an event in the European Parliament where we're talking about democracy narratives. And it was a very long panel. Several people had gone before me. And I realized like, oh, is anyone actually going to remember anything I'm saying now? And then I remembered my own rule, which is if we want to change narratives, we have to be the narrative. So I was just talking about experience, right? If I want people to remember what I have to say and my point, I should make them feel and experience it. And so I asked people to do something I read about, which is called like a physiological sigh, which is like taking three deep inhales and then relax, you know, letting it go. And it's meant to activate our vagus nerve, which helps us move from that fear-based part of our brain into our more hope-based brain. And the message I had was actually that's part of democracy, that if we want democracy to function better, we need that emotional intelligence revolution to actually understand, like, if that's true, if doing that breath work makes me more contemplative, reflective, prepares me for empathy to understand someone else's opinion. Shouldn't every single meeting of parliament involve that? Like, there's all this knowledge about how humans actually function. Similarly, for example, in peace talks, there was this finding, I read that, you know, a lot of the talks are about like borders and reparations and things like that. But often what the people negotiating most want is for the other side to see their pain. And so if we actually want to improve human behavior, we have to understand human behavior. And so my idea there was basically, this is a little bit of a prototype to actually, you know, instead of telling people you should start doing breath work, let's also actually do it. And it is really, I mean, interesting to see that that really resonated with people. So I'm already now thinking, oh, what else can I do next? What's the next trick? But seriously, yes, my current thinking now is maybe to develop a sort of toolkit for political self-regulation. Because I find, like with these five shifts, just making things easy for people to do, creating these practical tools is really important. So I've been starting to think about the activist brain, as in the current activist brain, our reactiveness, our sort of tendency to outrage and anger. And could we shape a new activist brain, which is much more based on empathy and curiosity and understanding?
Yeah, because activist burnout is real, a friend said once. It's very exhausting to always be fighting.
Absolutely.
Even if you're fighting for something.
Yeah. Also, this approach called deep canvassing, which has been very effective in referenda. So in terms of LGBTQ+ rights, this approach of deep canvassing has been very effective, which is people going door to door to try and convince someone to vote for equal marriage in a referendum. In the US, but also in Ireland, made a really big difference. And the approach isn't, rather than saying like, here are the facts, discrimination is wrong, it's actually much more focused on listening. So basically the person, the canvasser, shares their experience and then asks the other person to share back. And so being listened to is such a powerful experience. The campaigners in Ireland, actually, they were talked about, they missed that deep canvassing. It involves so much, you know, positive human contact.
After it was over,
actually missed it. They missed that spirit of community and togetherness. So I think that's kind of relevant also, like, you know, if we want democracy to be vibrant, it needs to be togetherness, not just around elections. But what I'm thinking about a lot is, how do we bring that deep canvassing spirit, that power of listening, into mass communication, into political communication, into parliaments themselves? Maybe it's like hope-based part two, or the, you know, it feels like there's, I basically don't know yet, but it definitely feels like that's a really important, like, next step we need to work on.
Do you feel you have allies in politics as well?
Yeah, I mean, you just look around us, you know, we have that negativity bias where the sort of fear-driving politicians take our attention. But I mean, just like Zoran Mamdani, Jacinta Ardern, they are there and showing how it's done. Of course, there's Barack Obama as well. I'm always interested also to look beyond. I'm always trying to look a little bit beyond, say, global minority countries and seeing the global majority, other stories as well. But I think I worked with one MEP, French left-wing MEP called Leila Shaibi, who I met working with gig workers who are working for workers' rights. And she's really, I think for me, like the MEP is really standing up, I don't want to say the poor, but for, you know, like working class, for workers, driving that economic message I talked about earlier. And, you know, I was really insecure at first because I want to work with more politicians, but I'm saying, oh, like, can I actually be helpful? Like, this is this really great politician doing this work. And the one thing when I realized like this approach works was when I came back from my second meeting with her and her team, and she said, oh yeah, we keep asking ourselves, is this hope-based or not? So like that, I think, is where the effect is just for people to ask themselves the question. Don't need to completely redo things. But I think a lot of more and more politicians are recognizing that need to offer what I call visionary leadership, to show a vision of the change we want to see, to talk about those values. We desperately need people to start talking about like the importance of empathy and kindness, the way Jacinta Ardern and Barack Obama do, to make it common sense, but also above all, voices. So like Zoran Mamdani, the way he goes and just talks to people, I think that's a great example of being the narrative. People talk about like the sophistication of his social media campaign, But actually what he did was really simple. It was going and engaging with people. And I think that's where a lot of politicians fall down. You know, you can have the words, you can talk about togetherness, but you have to think, am I actually doing it?
This goes, I think, beyond just the progressive or left camps, right? Like, what would you say to people who are saying that this would be naive or...
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting, the idea of the naivety, right? So when we talk about love, kindness, breastwork in parliament, our instinct is naivety. You know, I can't help thinking, this is my, you know, my grumpy side coming out, that actually in this world where we have AI driving hate at such a scale, where we have capitalism, where such inequality drive, you know, creating such fear and insecurity, where we have climate change, all of these things, we're kind of going off a cliff, whoever, whether it's far right or centrist in power or even left, we need to really completely change a whole amount of things about how we live. But I think particularly with, especially with AI, right, the way that we interact with each other. So to me, the naive thing is to think that we can keep going the way we are without some kind of radical change and greater understanding of how humans work. And so, yeah, that's the thing to me is the naivety is actually to ignore all this neuroscience and psychology. Particularly, you know, what really alarms me is this strain of thought in, say, elite or in political circles that buys the narrative that people are racist or hateful or afraid of others. Because I think it ignores how much suffering people have had in daily life. We talked about a financial crisis in 2008, and then we had COVID. And it's, I think there's this really strong desire to just say, oh, people don't like migrants. But if all people hear every day is you're suffering because of migrants, that becomes the story in their brain. I think we need to have a little bit more faith in the humanity of our fellow human beings and see that actually there are possibilities. So I think maybe the first step, and actually after our conversation is over, I'm going to try a different kind of meeting with some colleagues working on international law called the possibility space. I'm a bit nervous because I don't know, I've never done one before. So I'm being a bit of an imposter and trying to just do it. But really, I just want to ask them what feels impossible and what feels possible. And I think maybe those politicians who are thinking things are naive, maybe they're speaking from a place of fear because doing something different is a bit scary. And it's easier to just say, oh, that's silly and naive. So I don't need to do it. Like it's, you know, we rationalize why we're not doing it. But maybe we just invite people to think, well, what is possible and what would you like to see happen?
Well, the thing is also that if you are pessimistic, it's often described as being realistic to be pessimistic about the future.
Yeah.
You know, if things turn out the way that you said they will turn out, at least you'll have been right.
Yeah, there's something called a cynical genius illusion where people who sound skeptical or negative seem more intelligent. But a lot of the time, those negative prognostications don't actually turn out the way people said. But we never go back to the people who were negative and say, oh, you said it would be bad and it wasn't so bad. You were wrong. But, it, you know, if someone says it's going to be better, we're always going to go back and say, oh, it's not as good as you said it would be. So I think, yeah, we also have to be careful. Basically, we have an inherent negativity bias, which is our survival instinct. You know, our brain is programmed to say, oh, could that be a threat? That's our first step. To me, with hope-based communication, the goal is to be conscious of that inner negativity. I've got a lot of it. And balance it out. So it's also about saying, okay, what could go wrong? But then have I also asked myself, what could go right? How can I make it right? And I think that's the key point.
Wonderful.
I had a colleague, Osama Buda, who's really gave me the chance to build hope-based communication. On his first day at Amnesty, he said that you have this slogan at Amnesty International, it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness, but you spend a lot more time cursing the darkness. And that's when I realized that human rights and hope are tools for dark times. You don't need a light unless it's dark. And in positive psychology, they say the same thing, that actually hope is a function of, well, Brené Brown calls it a function of struggle. It's unique among positive emotions because it's one that you activate when things are bad. So like, you don't need hope when things are fine. So this is what I always try and say in human rights, right? Like hope-based communication is designed specifically for talking about Gaza, for Syria, for the Uyghurs, of people in Congo. It's in dark times that you need the light, you need the hope, because it's about determination to keep going.
Yeah.
So I like to say it's a muscle, it's something you train. And it's, I'd like, for example, that's why I have this shift idea, which is like, you know, when the problem or negative or fear talk comes, you train yourself to recognize it and bring in the hope. But I think, yeah, what's also really key there is that work of imagination you talked about and the hope punk. is I think what happens is when we start imagining this better future, first of all, you realize it's not actually that science fiction-y because it ends up being a community in a park. But once you've articulated what you want in the future, you start to see the seeds of change all around you. And I talked before about sunlight makes things grow. And so, you know, okay, we need to pay attention to the racists burning down the refugee center. But when we don't talk about the 5 million Germans who organized themselves to welcome strangers and the 15,000 community initiatives that were started to do it, the danger is that the small number of racists become the narrative and they become the dominant story of how we think about the last 10 years. And so actually the majority of people want to be kind, welcoming people. But now the dominant narrative in politics is common sense is to be cruel. We have to look at the thing we want more of.
And I think it's also important, you know, you have had this experience. I've had this experience of being new in a place without having been refugees ourselves. You made a life for yourself in a new place. And I think it's extremely valuable to have made that experience that people, not even, you don't need everyone to be welcoming. You need one person to open a door and one person to make a change. And to actually change the course of your life, just like your grandmother, she climbed that barbed wire fence and she wasn't sent back.
Yeah.
That person could have made a different choice.
Yeah, absolutely. You've defined literally hope-based communication as the strategy, right? So being welcomed is more like receiving kindness is more likely to make us kind. But what brain science also shows is that seeing other people be kind to other people triggers the same parts of our brain as if we've received the kindness ourselves. And so the point is, what is the story we tell ourselves about the world, about politics? If the story we tell is that humans are cruel, we are more likely to be cruel. But if we see stories of kindness, that primes us to be kind ourselves, right? So the thing is, like we talked about earlier about culture, one of our biggest problems right now is that politics is serious and culture is kind, right? What we actually need is to break that down, that barrier, right? There's like a Berlin Wall of, you know, between politics and culture, let's say. But, you know, we need actually to bring into the news the kindness as well. So that is kind of the change we need to bring about.
Yeah, you have another quote. Zadie Smith.
So that was a speech she gave in Germany right after Donald Trump's election. So it's interesting. The Martin Nussbaum quote was written right after Trump's election 2016. And Zadie Smith gave this talk in Germany on optimism and despair. And she said, we all of us have multiple behavioral possibilities inside us. We're like an orchestra that's tuned by the conductor. And right now we're just hearing the most banal military voices. But all of us who have a different idea need to sing a different tune or sing along, something along those lines.
I think it's beautifully selected. Yeah. So she says, and I quote, if novelists know anything, it's that individual citizens are internally plural. Mm. They have within them the full range of behavioral possibilities. They are like complex musical scores from which certain melodies can be teased out and others ignored or suppressed, depending, at least in part, on who is doing the conducting. At this moment, 2016, I guess, all over the world, and most recently in America, the conductors standing in front of this human orchestra have only the meanest and most banal melodies in mind. Here in Germany, you will remember these martial songs. They are not a very distant memory, but there is no place on earth where they have not been played at one time or another. Those of us who remember, too, a finer music must try now to play it, and encourage others, if we can, to sing along.
So what Zadie Smith describes there is like the very practical political strategy that is inspired by Nat Schenker's story that I try and bring about, which is narratives change through repetition. And so if we all organize ourselves, we can change the narrative. But it only happens if we sing along, right? We have to say the things we want. And so I think feel like that's where Hope Punk is very important, because I think that kind of storytelling helps us realize what we actually want. And if we don't know what we want, we can't ask for it. And if we don't ask for it, we'll never get it.
And it also does not mean negating the challenges. So shifting the gaze, I think, is important. And then, you know, being able to have a different kind of debate around what the challenges could be.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, first of all, yeah, I'd love to see more storytelling around this because, you know, the things in life that drive us, that give our lives meaning are hard things. And so I think it's about overcoming challenges together. And when we do, so like for my next body of work around this activist brain, I'm drawing a lot on sports science. And when endurance athletes do hard things, they use intrinsic motivation. So motivated by inner values. And I think that's one of the things I'm trying to do with our activism is get us to cultivate and recognize those inner values that make us do. When we welcome refugees, we're not doing it because it's good for the economy and they're going to go and pick fruit and take care of us when we're old. We're doing it because human connection of doing good, of we want to help, usually comes from inside us. And so when we welcome a refugee into our home and we don't get along, right, we're not just going to kick them out. We work through it, but what motivates us to work through it, right? So yeah, I feel like there's just much more storytelling to be done of those challenges in doing the right thing and not in a sort of doom way. I think maybe in progressive spaces, it's always things are right or wrong. And then some of these challenges you described, and a lot of people working on refugees who say that, right? It's hard to tell stories of like the perfect migrant or the white savior. We need to just get much better just telling human stories. I think that's what's really important for hope to me is it's fear and hope. So what I try to do, my job is to get activists to find their hope and their values, right? The messages that will convince people and so on. And I've tried loads of different methods and worksheets. And what I realized is we start with the fear and from that we transform the fear into hope. So literally I'll get people to write down what they're against, what they're afraid of, and then say the opposite of those things. Okay. So our hope comes out of the fear. You can't separate them. We've got our downstairs brain and our upstairs brain, you know. You do the breath and you move from one to the other. Like, I think the mistake is try and separate the two. It's okay. Like a duality.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think it's time for my last question. If you are finishing school like you were 18 or 20 years old today in 2026, which advice would you give yourself?
That's such a nice question. Oh, there's so many things. I think there's two sort of angles to it. I'd like to first talk about like young people in general. My first instinct is actually to ask them for advice rather than the other way around. Because I think, like I said, I feel there's a lot we need to fix and what we need are new visions. And I really want to hear the new visions from them. So I guess the advice for them would be maybe, you know, not to fall into the temptation that many of us had when we were young, which is just to show, look at what's wrong with the world. But actually, we desperately need you to bring new ideas and new alternatives. Personally, for myself, you know, one thing, what's interesting is the more I look at the science, particularly to sort of prove to the people who think this is naive, say, look, here's all this neuroscience and psychology proving that breathwork in the European Parliament is a good idea. A lot of this neuroscience just comes together with Buddhist spirituality and meditation. And my father's been practicing Tibetan Buddhism for like 40 years. So I kind of think like I went when I was young to a Tibetan retreat center in the west of Ireland. And I spent a week or two there. And I really imbibed through my father all this stuff about compassion and loving kindness. And I thought, it's always been part of my philosophy, but I never practiced it. You know, I never did sort of meditation and mindfulness practice. And now I'm thinking, oh man, imagine if I just known all of that stuff, then I had this wonderful opportunity to actually be much happier the last 20 years instead of always feeling bitter and having fights with colleagues without meaning to and like all the insecurity. I mean, it would have been there anyway, but I'm like, oh yeah, that would have been really smart to like keep doing that mindfulness practice all that time.
So very last question. Do you see yourself as a bridge builder?
Oh, that's really good. I've been saying in human rights, we need to move from being firefighters to gardeners. So I'm not very good at building things. I don't know if I'm a very good gardener either, but I'm going to use my media training and shift. I'm going to bridge away from that because say I'm a gardener. I'm trying to grow new things.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it was an absolute pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
That was Thomas Coombs, founder of Hope-Based Communications. I invited him because I think he's exactly what Hope Punk is about. For Thomas, hope is a muscle, something that can be activated in dark times, especially in dark times, and that can guide anyone when working towards a positive future. Thomas says his work is about finding the hope in every story. His approach is informed by brain science and psychology. Because human brains are wired for change, it matters what kind of stories we tell ourselves and others. In human rights communications, Thomas's field of work, he says that fear used to be the driver for the stories he used to tell. Naming and shaming, however, did not lead to the change he had hoped to see. So how do we tell stories of positive change? How do we activate a kind of hope punk politics, as Thomas called it in our conversation? Thomas advocates for 5 shifts. The starting point is going from fear to hope, inviting people to feel the emotions that they want to feel when whatever change they want to see is actually reality. Choosing emotions strategically, so to speak. And this, by the way, is something that other guests in this podcast have spoken about as well, albeit in different contexts. The second shift in perspective is about going from problem to solution. The third, about going from against to for. The fourth, about reframing a story from threat to opportunity. And finally, making the shift from victim to human. These 5 shifts form part of a toolkit that Thomas uses to train colleagues all over the world, and they are free for anyone to use under a Creative Commons license. The link to Thomas's website can be found in the show notes. For me, one core hope punk aspect of hope-based communications lies in its potential for opening up spaces for imagination. It matters what stories we tell in our societies, and for this, culture is hugely important. On that, we agreed. Literature, music, theater, they are not just nice to haves in free societies, but incredibly important to fostering our humanity. In a society in which anger and hate seem to be everywhere, shifting the gaze to their opposites, that means to empathy, love, and kindness, might just be the antidote we need. As Thomas mentioned, sometimes we think that sunlight will disinfect, but actually, it makes things grow. Thank you for listening to this first English episode of Hope Punk, a podcast about the power of choosing hope in the face of adversity. Next week's episode will again be in English and feature Omri Price, managing director of an organization we co-founded a few years back called Alliance for Europe. If you like this episode, please leave a review and subscribe, or write to me at maite@hopepunk.eu. My name is Maite Schomburg, and I look forward to hopefully welcoming you back to future episodes. Goodbye.